Today, a counseling session with God.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So I refer to it this way. I'm going to go through another psalm, Psalm 82, this time, because the opening line of the psalm is, God has taken his place in the divine council. And then it says, in the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. That judgment, which we'll come back and talk about that verse, verse 1, in a moment. I mean, it's a profound line. And this is, you know, of among the poetry of the Psalms, this is among the best. I mean, it's just magnificent, powerful language to get across these points. Anyway, in the first verse, when he takes his place in the divine council, and then it says, in the midst of the gods, he holds judgment, it's the word mishpat. He's passing judgments, making pronouncements about what should be done, what should not be done, what has or hasn't been done as well as it should have, and so on. And it's the same kind of judgment that is described when we talk about the book of Judges, for instance. And so in trying to figure out how to communicate what this is really saying pertinent to us, and it is powerfully pertinent to us, I wanted to translate the perspective that we would bring to the psalm from where it was for them. And in their world, you know, the person you would go to when something was wrong, and it might just be wrong with you. Like, I need an answer to this. What am I supposed to do? What are we supposed to do? Our father died, and we don't have any brothers, but we have the inheritance. The person they went to was a judge. That was the reference that was given, and we would not think of it the same way. We only think of that for legal problems. I have a lawsuit I want to file or something like that. But in their world, with a much stronger sense of belonging to the community, the person that you went to for personal advice, give us some guidance, give us a sense of where to go now or how I'm supposed to think about this, was a person who also had a great deal of authority. And so their pronouncements were stronger than we would take them. They would refer to them in this way. It's a mishpat. This is a judgment, you know, that's being pronounced, but it also applied to things that we would take as advice. And so I would refer to this as a way for us to understand what we're supposed to hear from God if we were to bring one of our most important questions, by the way, and it is permeating this psalm, the nature of this question, I'll put it to you now. The world's a mess. What are we supposed to do with this place? How are we supposed to respond to the terrible reality in which we actually live? And it's exactly the same kind of thing that we would bring to a counselor when we finally reach the point where we overcome, from my generation, the embarrassment of having to admit that we need help. Who would admit that? Down, you know, to all of us having to say, am I willing to spend the money? Or find a person I trust, in order to go to them and say, man, my life's a mess, or I've got things in it I can't figure out, problems I can't solve. What am I supposed to do about these things? I don't even have to know exactly what the problem is to know part of how to answer that question. That is, you know, we need advice in a lot of different things, in a lot of different ways. And some of that advice is very specific. Well, don't buy the 1982 Chevelle. I mean, I don't even know if there is one of those. But the point is, it's very specific. But a lot of the advice that we need, a lot of the counsel that we need to receive, is pretty broad. I mean, it would apply to anyone. It's why counselors can go and get a degree, not in you as a person. We're going to get a degree in Shelley Smith. I don't know who Shelley Smith is. That's not a reference to you if that's your name, by the way. I don't know a Shelley Smith. That's why I picked the name. Why am I being so defensive? The point is, I may not even have a Shelley Smith who listens. The point is, you don't get a degree in Shelley Smith. You get a degree in counseling or a degree in psychology or both or whatever. But you learn these broader general tools and truths that then you can apply to anyone, and maybe you'll make it more specific. My point is that in coming to God and saying, what are we supposed to do with this place? This is the answer we get. And this is God responding with that answer in a context that their world would recognize. And we would not so much, not in the same way that it's presented here. And so I'm just going to take this psalm and I don't think it's not just jocular, but in a sort of serious way, say, this is what it would mean for us if we were to go to God as a counselor and say, give me advice. Tell me what I'm supposed to do with this, because that's what he's doing in the answers that he's giving here. And I think it'll make sense to you as we go through it, why the response is what it is. And I'll tell you up front, I mean, what a big part of this is. The first five verses of this psalm, it's only eight verses. We'll read it in just a moment. The first five verses of this psalm are entirely about us believing that something else, someone else, is at fault for the things that have gone wrong and for the things we're having to face. And we need somebody to do something about it. So it's somebody else's fault. We're looking for someone else to blame, or we have already found someone else to blame, and we need something done about that person, those people. And so the first part of this is just talking about that, when we think somebody else is to blame. The second part is realizing we need to deal with us. We're the people who need to be confronted. And the third part is, and that's verses 6 and 7, by the way. And then the third part, the very last verse, just brings it up obliquely, but also in a way that you can't miss. I mean, it's the point that we need help. We need to ask for help. And that's the only way real change is going to come. So let's take it a portion at a time. But let me read the psalm to you first. And at the same time that we're doing that, translating it into something that I think should and would make sense to us, I also just want you to get the magnificent image of the psalm itself. So starting in the first verse, this is Psalm 82 again. It is God showing up in the council of the gods. And I know we want to take that as somehow offensive, or, you know, it can't mean that because there aren't any other gods. You know, it's a poem, and so he is using the language of appearing before other gods, and we're not going to sort of take that and, it's not euphemizing it, but it's something like euphemizing it into being the angels, for instance, or something like that. It's not that. These are the false gods. These are the gods of other nations that we're talking about. And so it's sort of like, why would God speak as if they're there? Well, you'll see. As we get further into the psalm, it becomes obvious why he speaks about them that way. But we are supposed to see him walking into a council of all these gods of the nations and taking his place among those gods. So here's how the whole psalm goes. Just eight verses. Psalm of Asaph. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked, he says to the other gods. Give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. That's what he says in his judgment. Then it goes on, and I think he's speaking to us to say what this is actually like. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. I said, you are gods, sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, like men, you shall die and fall like any prince. Arise, O God, judge the earth. For you shall inherit all the nations. A beautiful poem. What it opens with, that image that it opens with, is so powerful for an obvious reason. The statement, God has taken his place in the divine council in the midst of the gods, he holds judgment, is the way of making the declaration that among all the gods, he is the only one who holds court. We use the expressions, and I heard these growing up so often that I dumbed them down. The way we dumb down language, it's probably not exactly the right expression for it, dumbing it down, but we reduce it. We make it such an idiom that we lose the value of it altogether. It's the thing we do with being born again, you know, born again. It's not even two words. So we do that with this expression that we use, God of gods, you know, King of kings, Lord of lords, as if it is titular by its own right, as if it's an idiom. And it actually is descriptive as well. And it might be idiomatic, even in their use, but we're supposed to hear him saying he's the God when all the other gods gather that we would call God. He's the God they have to acknowledge is actually God. He's not King of kings. He's when all the kings gather together, he's the king of them. And when all the lords get together, he's the Lord over them. He's the God of gods. He's the King of kings. And so that's what we're seeing in verse 1. God comes into this divine council. All the gods are present. And he takes not a place, he takes his place in the divine council. And he, not they, not together, not give me some advice, he holds judgment. And what he says to them then, this one God among all who can actually speak to the answers, that one God says to them what would be for anyone who's familiar with the Psalms, the ultimately ironic expression in verse 2, how long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? That's the expression that all of Israel, the people who are singing this psalm together, given to them by Asaph, that's the expression the people have been uttering to him. How long, O Lord? If you go back to Psalm 6, they literally say it to him. How long? But you, O Lord, how long? They're demanding of God, Yahweh, when are you going to make things right? And so as God saunters into the position of all the other gods who rule over all the nations, what he says to them is, how long? And what he's doing is not deflecting the responsibility or attention from himself. That's the last thing he ever does. Instead, he's looking at the things we hold responsible for the problems and saying to them what we say to him, how long are you going to continue doing this? So as he holds court, what Israel is seeing, the people who sing this psalm, is that he's judging not just the nations, but the gods of the nations. And his judgment about his own people, why aren't you bringing justice? We'll talk about what those measures are in just a moment when we get to verse 3. He's applying to the rest of the world as well. This is because he is the God of the whole earth. That's going to be important for us when we get to the end of the psalm. I mean, obviously, it's important just in its own right. But as we're reading this psalm, it's important because what we need to learn at the end about us and about how we approach him. So so where we are right now is that God has made it obvious that he's the only one who can walk into the council of all the gods and pass judgment on them, and he does. And what does he pass judgment on them about? Well, verses 3 and 4 tell us this. Give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. And so, you know, what we're seeing is injustice, give justice to the weak. The idea that something is just wrong, you know, the people who ought to receive it aren't receiving it, whatever, give justice to the weak and fatherless. So what we see is injustice and then oppression, maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute, but then also the apathy or inaction that comes about on our part when we don't respond to those needs. So we're just not doing what we should, deliver them from the hand of the wicked. So injustice, oppression, apathy or inaction, whichever one you want to call it, that lethargy that goes with moral unconcern for other people, that's the stuff that God uses to measure not just his own people, not just those who are, you know, they've been given the law and told that they're supposed to do these things, But the whole world, all the nations face exactly the same judgment. And then the final statement of it, and if this is the omniscient narrator telling us this, Asaph writing it into the psalm, the Holy Spirit just putting it in these words so that we know something we didn't know before, or if it's Yahweh as part of his declaration looking to his people and saying, look, this is the reality of it. We finally get to the crux of this issue in the first five verses, which we have. We're the ones with the issue because we're seeing these gods as needing to be judged. And what are these gods that we think need to be judged? And Yahweh can walk in and he can pass judgment on all those gods of the other nations. What are those things? And what this is what he gives us in verse 5. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. Whoever it is that's trusting them and leaning on them is trusting on something that doesn't even have, you know, eyes to see, doesn't have ears to hear, doesn't have a mouth. It's the language that I would give you from Isaiah 41 and 44. Isaiah picks up on this, you know, whether he's getting it from Asaph's psalm or if these psalms of Asaph, as I've mentioned to you, are obviously dated after the first Asaph that we read about. Not all of them, but some of them are. So maybe it comes later. Maybe it even comes in Isaiah's time. I don't know. But Isaiah certainly uses the same kind of language, and he does it in two completely different ways, but making the same point. I'll just describe it for you. You can go and read it later on in the last half of Isaiah 41. He does it when he's saying to the gods, to the false gods, which one of you is going to make a pronouncement? Just say something. Get, you know, you all of you false gods, just tell us something about what's going to be. Just give us any declaration. Do something for us. And they do nothing. And then, and this is the part that makes this so poignant in the transition to the second part of the psalm, starting in Psalm 6 in a minute. We'll get there. But in the transition, he's going to rely on this. In Isaiah 41, the way he does it is he goes back and forth from saying about the gods the same thing that he's going to say about his people. And so he says about the gods, I mean, which one of you could say, just say something, and then he will say, they are as vain as the people who make them. The point being, my people are blind because they're worshiping gods that are blind. My people are deaf because they're worshiping gods that are deaf. They are as vain as the gods that they're crafting. And in Isaiah 44, he really, and you'll remember this passage when I start describing it to you. In Isaiah 44, towards the end of the chapter again, the way he talks about the gods is to say, somebody explain this to me. This is how Isaiah is talking. It's a mockery. It's an Elijah at Carmel kind of mockery of the Baalite, the Baal worshipers, you know. And so Isaiah does it this way. Somebody just explain this to me. I'm paraphrasing. Somebody explain this to me. A guy takes a piece of wood that he finds. You know, he cuts down a tree and he takes out the trunk of it. And he carves off pieces of it, and he takes those pieces, and he throws them in the fire, and he warms himself, and he says, oh, I'm so warm from the fire, and oh, look at this meat that I cooked over the fire, and I'm enjoying eating the meat, and oh, isn't it great that I can do this with the wood? And then he takes the rest of that wood that he carved off and used to make a fire, and he bows down and worships it. What sense does that make? The thing doesn't have ears to hear, eyes to see, a mouth to speak. He cooked his food over it, and then he worships it. This makes no sense at all. Don't you see it's nothing? Now, there's so much to say in there, obviously. Part of it, false. All gods are false gods if they're not Yahweh. You know, there's just one who's not a false god, and that's our God. That's the one. So that, I mean, that's profoundly important, right? Obviously. But in this context where God, in the first verse, is describing himself walking into the council of all of the gods and making a declaration about what they should be doing, and then saying in the middle of it that they're not able to do any of these things. They can't hear or see or respond in any way whatsoever. Is him saying, you find these injustices in the world and you want to blame someone else for it. You want to look up to the heavens and say, oh, it's Baal's fault. Oh, it must be Ashtaroth who's bringing about this evil. There must be someone else. And that's not the case. I'll get to that point in a moment. But even if it is the case, let's blame it on the gods. It's not our fault. The devil made me do it, Flip Wilson used to say. Y'all don't know who Flip Wilson is, but my generation does. A comedian, okay? The point is, even if we want to explain it by blaming it on a demon, and demons are real. I have no doubt about that. I don't have any qualms about spiritual entities and their reality. But if we want to blame it on these gods, whom Paul identifies with demons often, then, okay, there's a spiritual being out there. Let's say we do that. So we say, well, it's Baal's fault, and Baal is actually some fallen angel of some kind that's whatever. Okay, fine, it's not just nothing, even though the little silver idols that we make to worship him are nothing. Maybe there's some entity out there behind that false god. Okay, let's say that. And then let's blame all of this injustice and oppression and inaction on those beings. Then what are we supposed to do with that? Well, even if I'm not talking you out of it and saying, really, it's not their fault, let's say it is their fault. Then who handles that? You? Me? Are we supposed to figure out something to do about that? How am I going to fight those things? How am I going to stop them from bringing about this evil? Or do I recognize that there's only one who can walk into the council of the gods and hold them accountable for what they do? That's what I do. Now, this is the point where if you were coming to me for advice, pastoral, I'm not a counselor. I have a counselor in here producing the show, so she can raise her hand and say, don't say that. You'll create a legal liability for us if you say the wrong thing. I'm not doing professional counseling. I'm just a pastoral counselor. You know, I'm a guy who studied scripture and tried to help people a lot. And then I would send them to a professional counselor if they needed. We'll talk about an example of that shortly. Anyway, the point is that you come to me and you say, I need counsel. I've got these problems. And look, this is what my brother-in-law is doing. And this is what my aunt is doing. And this is what my neighbor's doing. And this is what my spouse is doing. This is what my kids are doing. And this is, can you imagine all these people doing the wrong thing? I mean, what am I supposed to do about them? And the first thing I'm going to say to you is you need to figure out where the line is between the stuff you control and the things you don't. So let's just start with all the people you've tried to control your whole life and ask how that's going for you. You know, that's not where we're going to find the answer. So the first step in this is to realize that for all the other gods in this psalm, which you'll see shortly is actually going to be about people, he's even implied that already because he makes the blindness and the deafness and so on of the gods equivalent to that in the people who worship them because they're thinking, oh, this God is going to come to our rescue. And so they don't help the ones who need help. They don't bring about the resolution, but they're praying to nothing. And that's why they're not going to get the help because they were supposed to do it, which we'll come back and talk more about. The point is, if we're trying to control that, we've put ourselves in the wrong place. They're in God's hand, not ours. James 4 says it this way, and I'll come back to this passage later probably. But the way James 4 says it is there's one lawgiver who's able to save and to destroy. And then he adds this line, who are you to judge another? He's the one who judges them. So our start. And again, if you were to come to me in a counseling session, my start with you would be to say, stop trying to fix everybody around you. Stop thinking that's your job, that you've got to make everybody else be a better driver, that you have to make everybody else think better about the world, that you have to keep them from making bad decisions. You can't do that. Maybe someday you'll be able to help them or give input that'll make a difference for them, but you can't correct and rebuke and fix all the problems that are in all the other people in the world. So what do you do with it? Just let it go? Oh, just say, oh, well, it doesn't really matter whether there's bad things going on or not. No, you give it to God. You have to have faith that God can do what you can't do. So we give other people to God. That's the first step. Well, let's let God take care of them, okay? Well, then where do we take the session, you know? That was the problem. I mean, the problem was all of those people. So now what are we supposed to talk about? Well, that's what I wanted to say to you next. And if you look in verses 6 and 7, it's an obvious turn in the psalm. And we know where this goes. You'll be familiar with it as soon as I read it. In verse 6, I said, you are gods, sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, like men, you shall die and fall like any prince. Now, we're used to this language from Jesus, using it in the New Testament in John 10. When he has been doing all the miracles he's been doing, and when he finally makes his statements about himself and how he's doing the work of his Father, and that brings testimony to who he is and so on, and he's condemned for that. Well, you've made yourself equal with God because you said he's your Father. Then Jesus' response to them is to say, to those religious leaders, is to say, well, isn't it your law that says you are God's, sons of the Most High God, and so on, quotes this passage to them and says, and if the scriptures can't be broken, then, you know, what do you got? Which one of us is breaking the law here, you or me? I mean, because he said we're sons of the Most High. So in that statement, we know that the way they read this passage made it about us, made it about people, you know, us. So it's not God saying in the council to the gods, you are gods. It's God saying something to men about them being gods. That's how they read it. Now, I think the way you get there in the psalm, as you're reading the psalm, it seems obviously this is where the discourse goes. That he's, you know, presenting to us the way we understand his righteous judgment of all the false gods. And then says, and I'm going to judge them because they are not practicing justice. They are bringing about oppression, and they are not acting on the behalf of those who have experienced injustice or oppression. So yeah, I'll judge them, but let me clarify who I'm judging. Because those things you want me to judge, all those false gods, those terrible other gods, they're deaf, dumb, blind, they can't do anything. Because they don't exist. They can't see because they don't have eyes. They can't hear and so on. And so in reality, what he's saying is they're not the thing that needs to be judged. Well, where does that bring the judgment then? Verse 6. We said, basically, let me put it this way. We said, Yahweh, you need to judge the gods. And Yahweh said, I said, you are gods. Sons of the Most High, all of you. And yet you, like men, are going to die and fall like any prince. They have two ways to get there. One is that he is, in the metaphor, saying this to the gods, as if he's speaking to these invisible gods. You are gods, sons of the Most High, all of you, but you're going to die with your princes. And in that statement, making us realize that it is the prince over those nations, the people who've been given authority in those places, that actually are the things being judged by God in these pronouncements to the, air quotes, gods, right? So that, you know, when you read in Isaiah or Ezekiel, when you read the description of these princes over the nations, you know, are we describing Satan? Are we describing a god, a spiritual being, an angel, or are we describing the king of Tyre? You know, which one is it? They're not separate. That's the point in those passages. The same thing is the pronouncement is being made about the man who's responsible, acknowledging the spiritual reality behind that, but knowing that who God made responsible for how we treat each other is not that God up there in the heavens somewhere, but us. So in other words, you could paraphrase verse 6 and verse 7 to mean this: I gave you the authority and responsibility to do the right thing. You're my sons, my representatives in this world. I gave you dominion over it. And yet, what did you do with it? You brought about all of the things that will bring to you the same judgment that's come to everyone before you who had that power and used it for themselves instead of others. You'll die just like all the other princes have died. That's what I think is going on in verses 6 and 7, which means in the counseling session, it's that extremely uncomfortable and unhappy moment when the attention gets turned away from all the things you were blaming, you know, to you. When the counselor puts out their bony finger and says, well, can we just talk about what that actually means for you? Because there may be something, you know, about your choices, responsibilities, whatever, that goes with that. And that's not a pleasant moment. I remember when I was a young pastor, So ages ago, and both, so I know you, it's hard to believe I can remember it, but I do. I remember as a young pastor, we had a youth, a teenager who had had some rough experiences, and I didn't understand what was going on. And I had done a little pastoral counseling with her, and realized almost immediately, yeah, this is way over my head. I wouldn't have any idea what to do. And so we were fortunate, blessed that we knew a professional counselor at the time, and just said, we'd like to provide counseling for this youth. And we started doing it for a few other people as well. It was a good experience. The point is that we just said, hey, we'll provide this counselor for you if you'd like to talk to someone more professional about this need. And she did. And so, she went for a few weeks. I don't remember how long. And so I was in my office one evening, and from my office, I could see sort of a courtyard at our church. And she was at another office doing the counseling with this counselor. And I remember looking out my window and noticing that she had bolted out of the building, out of the room that she was in, and then out of the building that we were in, out into the courtyard, and had leaned back against a pillar in the courtyard thinking nobody could see her. And I wasn't trying to intrude. I mean, it was just obvious right in front of me. And leaned back against that pillar thinking she was unseen, just shaking and sobbing with tears. And realizing that I don't know what the proper technical words for this is, but that, she'd probably had some kind of a breakthrough, some experience, some confrontation, comeuppance that, wasn't pleasant in the moment. But as it turned out, really was a breakthrough and an opportunity for her to grow from that. By the way, as an adult, one of the finest young women I've ever known, and has a beautiful life, has been blessed, and is in her late 40s to early 50s now, and just the Lord's really given her a great life. I'm not saying it all came from that counseling or something like that, but I am saying, getting there was not easy. And the least easy part of any confrontation like this is when the attention's drawn back to us. We don't like that. And I get that. Whether it's, I don't even know if this is the right word to call it, deflection or something. That's what we'd like to do. This is not me. Let's talk about something else. Let's move in a different direction. In logic, I know how to talk about it. When I teach logic, it's the tu quoque fallacy that we've talked about before. The thing that in the political cycles of the last 8 years or so have come to be known as these whataboutisms. What about this? What about that? What those are called tu quoques, meaning you too, right? So it's when your spouse says, I think you're eating too much food. And your response is, oh yeah, well, I saw you smoking the other day. Well, they're two completely different things. Why would you do that if you weren't just saying, I don't want to talk about me. I don't want to know what might be wrong with me. But that is what we want to say. We don't want to talk about what's wrong with us. I don't care. When I just laugh and laugh and laugh when I hear people say I'm a communist, because I say something they don't agree with diversity or something like that. It's like that's the weirdest thing. My whole nature is libertarian. I incline in that direction entirely, and I have zero affection or affinity for any kind of Marxism or communism that goes with it. And so if people call me a communist, I chuckle, I laugh, I just think it's ridiculous. And I feel sorry for them too, because there are other things we could talk about that would be more important. It's just not important to me. It doesn't affect me emotionally in any way whatsoever. Somebody starts talking about my nose, which by the way, looks fantastic on my mother, but on me, whatever. When somebody does that, I'm a little sensitive about it. I'm not sure I want to hear it. If somebody tells me I was acting in an angry or short fashion towards someone when I really was, I get shorter and angrier. Are you kidding? That's just stupid. I would say what they needed us. I don't want you talking about me if it's true. That's just how we are as human beings. Now, obviously, I don't want to stay that way, and I'm trying to be more mature about stuff like that, just like all of us are. But we all know the feeling. When somebody hits that sensitive spot, and it's sensitive because it's true, it's real, we want to deflect away from it. This passage, like so many in the scriptures, and we could just go from one to the next to make this point. God constantly says, stop pointing your finger at everybody else you think needs to be fixed. I'll take care of them, he says. and let's talk about you. And then we're like, well, what did you want to talk about? All the good stuff that I've been doing? And that's usually not where it begins. And so this is the second part. Let's admit that the problem is not everyone else. You know, we've been in the world for a long time. I mean, all the thousands of years that human beings have been in the world. And we've come up with one solution after another. And they're all attempts to fix everybody else. And you would think by this point, with the world being the mess it is right now, and if you're thinking to yourself, well, my world's not a mess, I'm blessed, then, you know, take your head out of the sand and look around you at the things that are not as comfortable as you are right now. That was a little harsh, wasn't it? I should say that softer. If you could give your attention to some of the people who are beyond where you normally see, and I mean, you can look far to the Middle East or to Ukraine, or you can look just down the road to the neighborhoods you don't drive into, or that someone would say to you, well, you don't want to be caught there at night, to realize that not everyone has it as well, is not as well off as you are. In that moment, shouldn't we say to ourselves, we've had thousands of years to try to fix this. We're not getting there. What's wrong? And that's what takes us to verse 8. So first, we have to take the step of saying, I'm not going to try to fix everybody else anymore. I'm not going to look at what's wrong with everybody else. I'm going to give that to God. That's the first step. I'm just going to give all the other people, all the other problems, I'm going to give those to God. The second step is me saying, and I'm going to be willing to listen when God says the problem is me. Now here's the problem with that. Once I acknowledge the problem is me, I'm still stuck with the reality that I am what I am because this is what I want to be. All of the history of the world and all of your own personal history and all of the choices you've made in that time have extruded exactly this person that is you. That's what's come from all of your history. So just saying to yourself, I think I'll be different now, probably isn't going to work any differently now than it did last year or the year before or the 20 years before that we did the same thing. So where are we supposed to go with that? Whether we're talking about it in terms of the world's history and where the world is messed up, or we're talking about it in terms of our personal lives and where we are failing, we don't have the ability to bring the change. So what are we supposed to do? Verse 8, we ask for help. Verse 8, arise, O God. The whole tenor of the psalm changes. It's no longer descriptive. It's no longer simply telling us what's been going on and how we can see things. Now it's us praying out together. Asaph gives us this one opportunity to turn back to God and say to him what we would say in response, which is not, no, God, I think I can fix those people or those gods. And it's not, no, God, I don't think the fault is mine. Our response to God saying, you're going to have to trust the rest of the nations to me, and you're going to have to see in yourself the thing that needs to be fixed, then our response to that is to say to him, then arise, O God, judge the earth. Why? Because you will inherit all the nations. If we want to give back to God a creation worthy of what he originally created, then we need him to be the one who makes that change in us and in others. Absolutely. If we try to turn anywhere else, we will be turning to something that can't even hear us. Doesn't matter what it is. Whether we're turning to things that we think of spiritually as the gods or something, you can worship all the spirits you want and none of them are going to hear you or care about what you're asking. That's how he's describing it at the beginning. So instead, we turn to the one true God. That's the only place we can turn and actually find help. If we were to turn instead to, you know, money, the economy. Hey, if we just had a better economy, people wouldn't. That's not true. Money is as deaf as the false gods are. It will not answer our prayers. No matter what we turn to, aside from Yahweh, we will not find the answer. There is one lawgiver who's able to save and to destroy. Why are we judging anyone else? Why are we looking anywhere else for help? And we're supposed to see, as James puts it, we're supposed to see that he's standing right outside the door. He is that close, and we need to ask him for help. That's where we go. So, as I'm looking at this today as saying, you know, what would you do if you were giving advice, you know, as if you were God and you're coming to God for advice, what would you expect him to say? This is what he would say. You only have one place to turn for help. Turn to me for help. If we want the world to be different, better, less cruel, more just, less hopeless, that's the only way to turn to the world's only true owner, the world's only true Lord, the only true judge, the only true deliverer, the only one who can walk into the room and judge all the other nations and then turn around to us. And when he has the right to say, I gave you the responsibility to do this right. And instead, you're practicing injustice and oppression and lethargy when it comes to making things right. You don't even care. The God who can and has, in judgment, pronounced all of that on us is the judge who also comes down in the form of a deliverer and says to us, ask me to help. I can change the world, and I can change you. If we will just ask. He will.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.